Welcome to Stone Ministries. We'd love to connect with you. Visit us online at stoneministries.org.au or follow us on Facebook and Twitter.
So let me read you a story to start tonight, and then we'll go. It's from the Max Lucado book, Outlive Your Life. This is how it starts. It says, fans rooted for the competition, cheerleaders switched loyalties, the coach helped the opposition score points, parents yelled for the competition. What was this? This was the brainchild of a big-hearted football coach in Grapevine, Texas. Chris Hogan skippers the successful program of Faith Christian High School. Players, 11 coaches, quality equipment, and parents who care make banners, attend pep rallies, and wouldn't miss a game for their own funeral. They took their 7-2 record into a contest with Gainesville State School. Gainesville players, by contrast, wear 7-year-old shoulder pads and last decade's helmets and show up at each game wearing handcuffs. Their parents don't watch them play, but 12 uniformed officers do. That's because Gainesville is a maximum security correctional facility. The school doesn't have a stadium, cheerleading squad, or half a hope of winning. Gainesville was a 0-8 going to Grapevine game. They'd scored 2 touchdowns all year. The whole situation didn't seem fair, so Coach Hogan devised a plan. He asked the fans to step across the field and for one night only to cheer for the other side. More than 200 volunteered. They formed a 40-yard spirit line. They painted Go Tornadoes on a banner that the Gainesville squad could burst through. They sat on the Gainesville side of the stadium. They even learned the names of Gainesville players so they could yell for individuals. The prisoners had heard people scream their names, but never like this. Gerald, a lineman who will serve 3 years, said, "People are a little afraid of us when we come to the games. You can see it in their eyes. They're looking at us like we're criminals, but these people, they were yelling for us by our names." Resurrection looks like something. Resurrection is more than a shake, rattle, and roll at the altar. My Bible college lecturer once said, "I'm more interested in the person you are when you get up than when you go down." A spiritual activation or a spiritual encounter is the beginning of a resurrection activation, but it is not the fullness of it. I can guarantee you in this room, there are a whole bunch of people that have had tens of hundreds, in some cases, of prophetic words and have never lived in one. I knew the room would go quiet when I said that. Everyone goes, "Don't stop talking about me like that. Shut up, Andrew, you don't know my circumstances." No, I know your Jesus. I know what resurrection looks like if you would just believe that God's got something better for you than what your current circumstance looks like, because broken is not your normal, and you never, ever, ever, ever have to settle for an inferior design for what you're called to. You say, "You don't know my life," but I do know resurrection life. The question is what do you agree with and what do you believe? Because whatever you agree with becomes your reality. And you might not agree with me, but you'll get whatever you agree with and I'll get whatever I agree with. And let's see who has the best life in the end. You don't have to be worried about what resurrection looks like, because at the end of the day, it's going to mess you up. Resurrection should mess with you. If resurrection doesn't mess with you, it means you've made resurrection fit your paradigm, which is less than what God has for you. You're quiet. I don't know what you plan on getting out of tonight, but I really do hope you leave. And some of you are going to go, "I'm in resurrection." Others are going to feel like there was a boot on your left bum cheek because you went, "Oh, I don't feel like it. I don't want to go back to this resurrection. I just want my Christianity to look like just that up thing there, and I don't want to do nothing." It's like when someone preaches on generosity. I love this. Someone preaches on generosity, and you come to the altar so that you can be generous. What's the point of that? No, you don't come to the altar. You go out to the coffee shop, and you take out your wallet. That's the point. Spiritual encounter, strategic activation. Can I be free tonight? And am I allowed to be? Okay. Because we don't want a Jesus that looks like that. So let's recap this morning really quickly. The story begins with resurrection, ends with resurrection, and is filled with resurrection. N.T. Wright says that. Because in the beginning, the earth was formless and void, and the Spirit of God hovered over the waters, over the face of the deep. And then he said, let there be light. Actually, let the one who is light shine. So in the face of darkness, God didn't fight it. He didn't get angry. He didn't pick it or start a Facebook group. He just said, let there be light. You don't need to fight something that's inferior to you. You just have to replace it with something greater. So no, the story begins with resurrection, it ends with resurrection, and is filled with resurrection all the way in between. By the way, N.T. Wright is one of the leading New Testament theologians. God doesn't fight darkness, he just illuminates it. So whenever you go into a dark place, you don't need to pray a constipated prayer. For God to turn up, please be with me. What do you mean? Where did he go? Just become aware and shine. It's not that complicated. Resurrection leads us to more questions than answers, and that's the beauty of resurrection, because it breaks walls that, you know, people put on us that make us fit, that make us become less than what we're called to. And I'm going to talk about that later tonight, about how you get people that are illegally squatting in your head out. And we have two responses to resurrection. One, we create a monument to resurrection. So we stand outside an empty tomb weeping and doing everything right, hoping that Jesus comes back to the empty tomb, which he is not coming back to, by the way. Mary, weeping at the tomb, could have fasted, could have prayed, could have done anything spiritual. And Jesus was not coming back to the tomb. Just because you have your mechanics of faith right doesn't mean you have the movement of faith right. So there you've got Jesus going, Mary, I love you, but I ain't coming back. I want you to come with me. He's compelling you forward. So you can either weep at an empty tomb that Jesus is not coming back to, but he once was there. So are you wrong? No. Are you full? No. So you can be weeping at an empty tomb hoping Jesus comes back, but he's not going to be back there. Or you can create a decoy Jesus that fits in the palm of your hand but doesn't hold you in his. So you can create a decoy Jesus. Decoy Jesus is great. You know why? Because decoy Jesus fits everything we say. Oh, I don't feel like blessing people tonight with my generosity because Jesus told me not to. Which Jesus are you talking about? I recall 5 loaves, 2 fishes, something like that. No, see, your decoy Jesus will tell you anything you want to hear. And what happens is we create a monument, so we're weeping at the tomb, or we're getting a decoy Jesus that we frame and shape ourselves, and we chuck him in the tomb. And if anybody gets too close, we go, don't you go too close, because if you get too close, you're going to realize he's a fake. And we defend this decoy Jesus. But actually, the third option we have is we join the movement of resurrection. Now, the movement of resurrection is going to be you living between the glimpses of saying yes before he's finished the question, because it's not about the question, it's about who's asking it. So it's about understanding, yes, resurrection might be messy, but resurrection is probably your only hope of living in the fullness that God has for you. Because resurrection has flesh on it. Resurrection looks like something. Just like Chris Hogan found out. When people went across the line for a group of people that did not deserve it, that death had filled their atmosphere, depression, insecurities, inferiorities had filled their reality, because everyone, through one mistake or whatever their mistakes were, had defined them by their mistakes and not by their true identity. So one coach had to say, I will bring resurrection in the midst of death. That's movement. That's scary, going, can we send some of our supporters over the line for them? Resurrection's not comfortable either. Let me show you the practicalities of resurrection as well. Can we get the next slide, please? Nick Page says this, resurrection is a political message. The early church preached resurrection. That is what Peter and John are saying to the temple powers. The man you killed came back from the dead. Resurrection is a potent destabilizing message. Resurrection gives hope. Next slide. In the Roman Empire, death was the ultimate deterrent. It was the fear of death which kept nations subdued and slaves obedient. But if people are going to start coming back from the dead, what happens then to power? What happens when the ultimate deterrent just doesn't deter people? What happens when a whole superpower says to you, if you don't do what we say, we will kill you? And your group of people says, and? Then what? This superpower was so sadistic that they would have groups of experts come in and figure out how the best way it was to flay somebody and keep them alive the longest they could. Caesar Tiberius, who was one of their rulers, had a special island. It was a little bit like Lost. If you went to that island, you never came back. And what he'd do is he'd invite other kings. He'd invite entertainers. He'd invite whatever he wanted to this island. And at the end of it, he would wave his hands. The soldiers would take them, and there was a cliff. And all they'd do is throw them right over. Yeah, this was that superpower. And then Peter and John are preaching resurrection. Do you understand why resurrection then was such a powerful message to the first century Christians? That why, if I ever told them that we celebrated resurrection once a year, they'd go, are you even saved? What else do you preach? There's another message? How do you miss the resurrection? Because it was our only message. It was the only thing that converted people, that death was finally beaten. And the fear that the superpowers of the kingdoms of the world, their big threats. Have you ever wondered why the martyrs died with so much dignity? Because death had lost the final word. Caesar ruled with death as the greatest threat and the last word. Jesus ruled by making resurrection our future hope and the final word. There's a big difference between last word and final word. And like I said this morning, when you have children, you understand this. Kids want the last word, but you have the final word. I can be on an airplane and say, can I please have the first class meal in economy? I've just had the last word. Who has the final word? The cabin manager. Do you understand that whoever's in charge has the final word? So there are situations, circumstances, and things that are happening in your life right now, and you would assume, and death is teasing you and saying, I have the last word. But you can know, and it depends on what you agree with, but you can know that the same power that raised Christ from the dead now lives in you, and with every breath you take, the kingdom of heaven bursts in you, through you, and out of you, and it explodes resurrection all around you. And you can say simply in the state that you are currently in, resurrection has the final word. That's what you can say. That's the same power and declaration prophetically that you have. Death can hover. Resurrection always beats it. So this is your passion and your fuel. And this is where we're going to get really practical tonight. I call this the greatness DNA. And I'm going to show you your new identity in resurrection life, okay? Your passion. What you're passionate about is your fuel. Your divine assignment is where you're going. Your ability is not your assignment. Your ability serves your assignment. As soon as we get our platform and purpose mixed up, we're definitely on the spiral down to having a gift overdose. Anybody ever meet someone with a gift overdose? I've met lots of people with a gift overdose. Every time you talk about something, they one-up you in the conversation because their gift is just so great. And then they one-up you. And it's just like, well, you know, okay, I'll shut up and just listen to you. Because then by in half an hour, they haven't realized they even stopped talking. So you've got this gift overdose because their platform has now become their purpose rather than the other way around. So now your divine assignment is where your destination is. We're all on the journey and we're all okay. Like God will bump us into the right direction. And so we're going in one direction. So here we've got two bumpers though that we live between, a priestly line and a kingly line. Okay, so this is 1 Peter 2:9 that you are a royal priesthood. This is resurrection with flesh on. This is resurrection in the reality that you live in here and now. So you've got royalty and kingship. Priestly line. So you've got two places. So priest has access and the king has authority. So you've got the priest that has access to heaven and the king that has authority on earth. Nowhere in the Bibles, in Chronicles or 1st or 2nd Kings, do you ever read this. The nation did because the priest was holy. You read, the nation did well because the king did well in the sight of the Lord. Why would a nation prosper under a good king and not a good priest? Because the priest didn't have the authority to rule. But the priest had access to get the download for the king. So if you swing too hard either way, you're going to be in trouble. Because if all you do is live in your priestly line of encounter, then you become a junkie with hundreds of prophetic words and nothing to show for it. On the other side, if you become too strategic as a king, you become self-sufficient because you're just so good at what you do. The ultimate convergence of heaven and on earth is understanding your priest that has access and your king that has authority. Presence, power. Are you guys getting that? Okay. So in your priestly line, you have a spiritual encounter, altar call moment. On the kingly line, you have strategic activation and a call to altar. That's not a typo. You can have an altar call, but if you don't have a call to altar, you then get trapped here. And people are always going to ask you, so what's the dream on your life? And you constantly talk about the dream on your life without ever living in the dream on your life. So there's a heavenly experience and there's your heaven engaging earth. So through your strategic activation, that's what actually comes to earth for you to bring resurrection everywhere that you go. So what happens on the altar? We go between the two and we get clarity the whole way. But in the altar call moment, God does a work on you, and in your strategic activation, you outwork what he did. When you're on the floor, I've been on the floor, God does something amazing. But if I get up and don't outwork what he did and what he showed me, then it's been of no use. God says, I'm going to take you to nations. Oh, that's so awesome, God. I just love that prophetic word. So you wait for every service for someone to tell you, you're going to nations. But you never, ever, ever listen to anyone going on a mission trip and buy a ticket. The ultimate convergence is king and priest. And therefore, for us to live in resurrection, we have to know how the two work. That is a rat. In New York, they had a rat plague. And people were coming through, exterminators, killing all the rats. So they came through and they were killing all the rats. Then more rats would come. They'd kill all the rats. More rats would come. They kill all the rats again. More rats would come. Until somebody higher up actually thought, you know what, we're killing rats and they're not going away. Maybe we should just get rid of the garbage. You and I can deal with rats our whole life. Fear, insecurity, inferiority. We can live with it our whole life. We can go from altar call to altar call and never, ever, ever get rid of the garbage. Because we respond to get rid of a rat when we really have to take out the garbage. Cities and nations will not be transformed by constantly killing rats. We need people willing to to say we will get deal and get rid of the garbage. Now, how do you do that? One, you have to have intercession that strategically places you in places of influence. Then from the place of influence, you deal with the garbage rather than exterminating the rats. Why would this come right after I talk about how great you are as a royal priest? Well, because a priest and a king knows that there is a spiritual encounter that you need to give you the download to get rid of the rats and the garbage. But the king is the one that has the power to get rid of the garbage. Let me explain. When Jesus went to the cross, he dealt with the rats. When he walked out of the tomb, he took out the garbage. When he went to the cross, he dealt with all our sins, all our sicknesses, all the things, all the smallest insecurity you have that is less than your divine design. So everything he dealt with. But when he walked out of that tomb, all the garbage had been taken out. Why? So that meant the rats don't come back. The rats don't come back. Because resurrection is now the final word. No matter what you are going through, no matter what you're facing, death might think it has the last word, but resurrection has the final word. And so may I challenge you with this one thought before we go any further, is why are we standing at an empty tomb weeping for Jesus to come back to something he's not coming back to? He has moved on. He doesn't change, but he moves. And resurrection has movement to it. You cannot have a move of God without the movement of God. That is a lion behind a cage, wild, filled with instinct, filled with leadership. Yet, a cage can hold it together. When Isaiah turned 3, we took him to Australia Zoo. And he loves Australia Zoo because it's got the animals from Madagascar at it. And we walked by the lemurs, and he made me put, I like to move it on my phone, so he could dance for the lemurs and King Julian. And as we did the whole tour, they were talking about their conservation at Australia Zoo. Because we only see one part of the zoo. There's a whole other part where it's filled, where they are doing research and doing the breeding program for different animals and whatnot. And so there's a conservation zoo. And so I was really moved by that. I went, wow, they've really set something up for reproduction for the future generations. But if you've ever been to a circus or you've been to another kind of zoo where all they have is great animals in cages for people to look at, to prod at, to feed, to whatever, that is, there is no conservation there. They are just animals behind the cage. Interesting thing is that they both look the same but have two different foundations. Just like a burial and a planting look like the same thing. The only difference is what happens in time. Oh, and also servanthood and people pleasing looks the same. I'll let that one sit. Servanthood and people pleasing look the same. The only way you'll know the difference is when you tell the person no. It's the only difference. Because that's all it takes. Take one disagreement and you'll know who was people pleasing and who was serving. Humanity cages what it cannot control. It's our very human nature to take something that is wild and free and then put cages on it because we don't know what to do with it. This is the point with resurrection for us here and now, is that when people are out working their divine assignment in resurrection and we don't know what to do with it, we put frames on it so that we can have it under control. Oh, we don't get you. Oh, this is the best part, is you can tell someone living in resurrection when they're constantly innovating. They use four words all the time. I have an idea. All the time. And people who don't understand innovation go, that's nice. They don't catch anything. They don't understand anything. So if they do, if they continue to have a dialogue with you, they're going to try to put frames on what your dream is when your dream might not have frames on it at all. Resurrection needs to stir us to a point of innovation. Resurrection needs us to see the world as one big creative pot to say, God, what can you do with me now? So you hit a brick wall. Figure a way around it. Oh, I lost part of my income. Maybe God's creating space for you to innovate. Why? Because death does not have the final word. Resurrection has the final word. So whenever you get hit with a situation and a circumstance that is less than what you're called to, it's time for resurrection. So if your identity finds comfort in a cage, then your authority will be limited to the opinions and expectations of others. And your resurrection life finds its way back to the tomb. Have you ever been just like running a million miles an hour, favors coming, things are lining up for you, and then suddenly in one conversation, stupid coffee with the dumb person. You lose your dream over a latte. Just like that. Over. Because one person who couldn't see what she saw said, I don't believe in you. They don't use those words because they're more polite than that. And suddenly an opinion strips you of the God dream that he put in you. One opinion. Is that all your dream is worth? Is that all the prosperity that he has for you worth? One opinion. You're going to tick off one person. And you go, I'm not going to do it now. I told you I was going to stir up people tonight. Why? Because I don't want to see anybody live another day not living in their divine assignment. I'm passionate about seeing people live in resurrection. Why? Because I refuse to let the world get inferior second-grade Christians that settle for mediocre because they justify their brokenness. Come on. You got to understand, it's not worth it. It's not worth it. If you make a mistake, you get up and you walk on. Big deal. But I'd rather you not live in fear and regret and say, well, I messed up a couple of times. But at least you were moving forward. At least you were propelled forward by resurrection. Let me put it this way. When you allow the insecurities of others to define your destiny, you become a slave to their fear. Have you ever had an idea and someone thought, wow, that's a good idea, but if you do it, that's going to make me look worse? So I better not. So I'm going to try to pull you back. Let me put it this way. Have you ever not wanted to go on a diet, but you wanted to look better than everybody else? Okay. This is like in Mean Girls, where she gets her friend to eat bars that are full of carbs, so that she looks better. Let me put it this way. If I don't want to do the work, and I want to look good without doing anything, and just so that you look worse and I look better, that's like me hoping you get fat without me going on a diet. So in order for my destiny to look better without me doing any work, I just hope you don't get yours. And realize this, whatever you do with somebody else's dream is a reflection of what you'll do with yours. Whatever, how you talk about somebody else's dream, how you present somebody else's dream, how you treat somebody else's dream will always be a reflection of how you treat your own. Always. And we have enough fears of our own, let alone being ruled by somebody else's. Let me get this to you. That a leader who does not lead from their true identity is just a slave with a fancy title. A leader that does not lead from their true identity is just a slave with a fancy title. So here's some foundational questions on how to get squatters out of your head. One, how many opportunities have they created for your dream? This is quantifiable, by the way. You can actually number it. How many opportunities? So think of all the people. I'm going to blank this out because you're going to read it. Before you make a decision or you're in the midst of making a decision, think about all the people that live there. Because lots of people do sometimes. And you go, am I going to tick off? So, oh, hold on. No, I better not. Then what about my third grade teacher? I'm not sure. What about my lecturer who thought I wasn't good enough? And then, so you got all these people that live there before you make a decision. Now, you've got to go through those people one by one and then ask yourself these questions. How many opportunities have they created for your dream? How much time have they invested in your dream? How much money have they invested in your dream? This is the crossover bridge part. Because they can talk about it. They can even create space for it. But do they put money where their mouth is? Like, how much money have they said, Andrew, or whoever is, look, I don't know what your dream is, like, fully, but I get you're passionate about it. Well, here's a $100 coffee card because you're going to have to meet with clients. Let me invest in your dream. Like, it's not about the amount. It's about what they're seeding. Like, if they're not putting money into your dream, why would you let them have a say? Have we got to get smart people? Priest and king. Kings knew how to rule. Do you trust them with the details of your dream? Have you ever been talking to somebody and just felt, I better hold that back? And then sometimes you say it anyway. And one of two things happens. Either they say, that's nice. Yeah. Or they take it as their own. I had this great idea. And you're like, I did that. And finally, and this is just a facetious question, how many of your bills do they pay? Like, if they're living in your head, they should at least be paying some of your bills. Don't you think? Like, at least some. Yeah. Like your mobile bill or something. If they're living rent-free in your head, there's something wrong. That's right. And they're defining your dream. Please understand this. We have a lifespan on this planet, some longer than others. You know, I want everyone to live a long life, healthy life. But at the end of it all, we are going to make a difference. We're given the opportunity to make a difference. And history will tell us whether we actually believed what God said about us. History will show. The stories your great-grandchildren tell about you will determine whether you believed what God said about you or not. Does that make sense? Hey, okay. Okay, African proverb. Want to run fast? Run alone. Want to run far? Run together. So, yes, you have to get people out of your head, but then there are some people that should actually be there. Good filters, good people, kind people, those that are for you. And you know those questions here, they're not just for people that you're trying to get out of your head. They're to determine who can stay. Everyone needs someone else to dream with them, partner with them, love on them. These are good questions. So here are some reactions to disagreement. Okay, we talked about what happens when you have a group of people, because we all have to serve one another. That's the point of resurrection. If Peter and John preached resurrection, their model of church actually showed what it looked like. They were all together in one accord. They met together daily. They ate together. They broke bread together. And so there was a unity amongst them. But in a group of people, no matter how big, like you could have a family of three and disagree. Heck, you get married, you disagree. So you can do anything with a group of people, and eventually you're going to disagree. I'm actually, like I said this morning, tonight's going to be super practical. So one, ask the questions to get people out of your head or keep people in. Number two, what is the reaction when people disagree in your resurrection community? One, they will try to convince you through conflict. Just because someone disagrees with you doesn't mean they don't like you. Sometimes people disagree with you because they see something better on your life than what you see. Isaiah convinces me every morning, or well, attempts to convince me every morning, that he should have a chocolate milkshake for breakfast. He's three. I'm asleep. He comes to my bedside right here. Daddy, wake up. Daddy, wake up. Then he does that. or that. But, you know, he goes, I've got a good idea. I'm like, what is it? We should have chocolate milkshakes for breakfast. Notice he says we. So if you're going to try to, if you're going to disagree with my thought about, actually, Isaiah, maybe you should have a piece of toast or cereal for breakfast. He's going to try to convince me through conflict. He disagrees with my thought that toast should be for breakfast and not a chocolate milkshake. But he'll convince me through conflict. And you'll find in your life, in your circle of resurrection, that people will disagree with you. And they will create conflict, but in only in order to convince you that maybe there's something better for you. Maybe there's something greater in your destiny. Second of all, they'll cooperate with you through trust. Jesus had a great group of people, and he said something that messed with a whole bunch of them. He said something along the lines that he said in a particular area. He said, you shall eat my flesh and drink my blood. And that freaked a whole bunch of people out. What they didn't realize was he was speaking in an area where the god that they worshipped in that area was Dionysius, and the worship of that area was they used to drink his blood and eat his flesh in order to be powerful like Dionysius. So what Jesus was doing was replacing the model where, because Dionysius was a warrior and they'd fight and it was all bloodshed and war, whereas what Jesus was saying was, I'll give you life. You need to replace that model with this one. That's all Jesus was saying. But people didn't get it. So people went, we're leaving. We're gone. We're done. Jesus, you're weird and you're saying some stuff. But then Peter says, Jesus turns to Peter and says, you're going to go too? Isn't that a great team building exercise? Say something completely crazy and see who hangs around. He turns to the guy that he loves and his team member and he goes, you're going to leave too? And Peter says this, Jesus, where would we go? For you have the words of life. I have nowhere else to go. Why did he say that? Because it was covenant over content. See, sometimes you're going to have to follow a leader or you'll be in a community of resurrection where you're going to have to believe some crazy ideas. Someone will come up here and go, I believe we can change the world. Some of you are going to go, uh-uh, I'm out. And do you believe them? What's up to you? Are you going to cooperate with them and just trust them? Or finally, and this is the one you don't want to do, is you're going to complain about me through gossip. They're the three. You're going to convince me, you're going to cooperate with me, or complain about me. In any disagreement, this is what's going to happen. Now, the bad thing about the last one is this, is any leader in any sphere of influence is not going to be perfect. No leader is going to be perfect. But they're a leader for a reason. That means they carry influence. But if all you do is complain about them, you're eventually going to complain to somebody that likes them more than you. And it's going to come back to them. Now, depending on their leadership style, they'll either meet with you very nicely or they will not deal with you ever again. So those are the three options we have during disagreement. Now, what I'm suggesting is do the first two. You can convince, like cooperate is one thing. It's like, yep, I'm with you. I don't get everything you say, but I'm with you anyway. But if you've got to choose convince or complain, choose convince. If you want to stay in resurrection community, convince. Never, ever, never, ever sacrifice your relationship on the altar of being right. I always say this to my closest friends. I would rather fail with my friends than succeed with people that don't like me. Because at least we'll have fun on the way down. If I could have the music team, please, as we bring it to a close. My observation here is the gospel spend more time telling us how Jesus picked his team than telling us what he did. So in Jesus' model of leadership and what he wanted to do to transform the whole world, he went, you know what? I'm going to bring resurrection into their reality, and so I'm going to show you how I pick my team. I'm going to show you that you are going to need people around you to serve with you, to partner with you, to stand with you, to speak into your life, to convince you, to cooperate with you, and sometimes they're going to complain about you, and then due to whatever you feel to do, you're going to deal with it. So there is something about having a team around you. Who knows that you cannot be a self-made man or woman? Like, let's be honest, you cannot be a self-made man or woman. If you proclaim to be a self-made man or woman, you are either delusional or you have very few friends. But T.D. Jakes says it perfectly about the three types of people we'll always have in our lives when we are walking in our divine assignment. Number one, confidants. The confidants' commitment is to you, not because of your cause or job description. These are the people that love you for you, not your title, that would stay in relationship with you even if something changes in your job status. These are the people you don't have to put a mask on around. These are the people that when you're at home and they knock on the door just because they drive by, you don't feel like you have to put makeup on. Because who you are when they're not there is who you are when they are there. These are the confidants, the ones that stand with you. Ones that are not interested in your title or your friends because they get something out of you. Covenant over content kind of people. Second group of people are the constituents. The constituents' commitment is to the cause and vision. These are great people to have around because they see the vision that you've proclaimed. They see the job or the cause that's in front of you. And they go, we're going to stand with you to see that project fulfilled. I'm with you, man. I'm with you. The problem is when we get these two mixed up and we take somebody that is with our cause and we bring them into our confidant circle. And then they leave because the cause shifted. And the cause somewhere else is now greater than the cause you're presenting. Then when they leave, you get bitter and angry when it wasn't their fault at all. You brought them in into the wrong circle. Like, they're there for the vision and the mission, not you. And are they good people? Yes. But you've got to know that there are certain building apparatus that you need for a particular job. Let's just put it this way. They're like the scaffolding. And sometimes scaffolding shifts. Some things change. They're there for a season. And when they go, this is what you do. You bless them because they're fulfilling the God call on their life. Don't get mad when someone leaves to fulfill the calling of their life when all they did next to you was to fulfill the call of God on your life. Bless them when they go. See, your confidants never leave you because your job title never makes a difference to them. And finally, you've got your comrades. The comrades' commitment is for what you are against. Have you ever had people that come alongside you that you've never really known for very long, but they dislike the same things you dislike? They're like, I'm with you. We're at war with this thing. Like, come on, let's just do it. It's like having a group of on Facebook that all hate the same thing. Like, we're together, we're partners, we're this and we're that. But here's the problem with having comrades in your confidant circle, is they're fighters by nature. And so as soon as you bring a fighter by nature and you become intimate and you give them details of your life, when they've finished fighting what you're both against, guess who they're going to turn on? You. And I guarantee you, each one of you has read up there and gone, I know someone in there, and in there. I'm only trying to bring clarity so that you can live in resurrection. If you wanted revelation in theology, listen to this morning. You want practical application? Get tonight. The key to leading something significant out there is knowing the difference between these three. Your confidants, your constituents, and your comrades. Don't get the lines mixed up. Your confidants, Jesus had three. So you're going to be doing pretty well if you have seven. Five to seven people. It's just you. You can tell your confidants are, because they don't bat an eyelid when you say something inappropriate. But your constituents are there to stand beside you and fulfill the vision. But when they get their own and a better opportunity, they're gone. The best way, bless them. Let them do better before you get bitter. Yeah. Finally, comrades are there. Yes, there are times and seasons where you need to fight against something, but don't make them a confidant. And we will all lead and live well in resurrection. Finally, a conspiracy is a group of people who share the same breath. Who do you share breath with? Your confidants? Absolutely. They're the ones that you partner with, the ones that you share your community with. When the prodigal son came home and the father took him back in, I want you to see this. When the father took him back into the tent, what he was saying to the whole community was, that boy and me, we now share the same breath again. When Jesus breathed into the glorified mud pie that was Adam, he was creating a resurrection conspiracy. In John 20, when Jesus breathes on his disciples, he's saying, welcome back to the breath of God. Because resurrection is as close as the air that you breathe. If you go, Andrew, I want to live in resurrection. It's easy. Just that's resurrection. It's now what you do with that breath that determines whether other people experience that resurrection or not. Let me finish with the close of this story. After the game, the teams gathered in the middle of the field to say a prayer. One of the incarcerated players asked to lead it. Coach Hogan agreed, not knowing what to expect. Lord, the boy said, I don't know how this happened, so I don't know how to say thank you. But I never would have known there were so many people in the world that cared about us. Resurrection looks like something real, tangible, here and now. A small gesture that brings life in the midst of death.